Hey, my name is David Thibodeau, and welcome to the Sports for Social Impact podcast, the podcast that explores all the ways that sport can put purpose at the center of what we do to have the maximum impact. We try to explore a range of topics with guests from all over the world for how sports can be used to tackle challenging societal issues, ranging from homelessness, climate change, gender equality, inclusion, education, and so much more. Thanks for joining in on this conversation. So the news story for this episode is a little bit different than some of the stories we've highlighted before. Usually we talk about sort of the positive things about sport and some of the stories like that. But this story I felt like really needed to be highlighted just because of the severity of it. And it, you know, really goes to show that there are a lot of problems in sport that still need to be addressed as well. So this story has been developing over the last 6 or 7 months here in Canada. So on April 20th, a woman filed a $3.5 million court action against Hockey Canada and unnamed players, alleging that she was sexually assaulted. The case was settled out of court by Hockey Canada. The federal government ordered a review to determine if federal money was used in the settlement. Hockey Canada executives were then called before Parliament's Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage. The committee was told that the settlement required the woman to accept a non-disclosure agreement. The federal government and some sponsors, like Scotiabank, started withholding funds. This happened all before July 2002. It was then revealed that Hockey Canada uses funds from minor hockey hockey memberships to pay for uninsured liabilities, including sexual abuse claims. It was called the National Equity Fund. The parliamentary committee was then told that non-disclosure agreements were used in other settlements of other sexual assault complaints, totaling $8.9 million and 21 complaints since 1989. Over the months of September and into the beginning of October, a few other details have come to light. This has led to most of their sponsors to withdraw support, such as Esso, TELUS, Nike, Tim Hortons, Canadian Tire, and many others. Several provincial hockey associations have also stopped sending funds to the national organization. So Quebec, Ontario, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and I believe a few other provinces as well. On October 11th, 2002, the entire board of directors stepped down. Now, this is, obviously totally unacceptable and needs to be addressed by, the Hockey Canada. And will be interesting to see how they move forward from this scandal, and work with their, provincial associations and their sponsors and the federal government to, rebuild their brand and see how they can, do better in the future. The story just really goes to show how there's still a lot of, toxic, a really big toxic culture in a lot of sports, and hockey is not immune. It's not the only one like this, right? It's many other sports as well. But it'll be interesting to see how Hockey Canada moves forward. So part two of the climate change and sport episode. So in this episode, we talk more about the specific carbon emissions from sports and how to offset them and reduce carbon emissions in sport. So it's estimated that the Rio Olympics in 2016 released 3.6 million tons of carbon dioxide, while the 2018 Russia World Cup released 2.1 million tons. Obviously, these are really, big sporting events, and not all sporting events have the same kind of impact. But it just goes to show that, these sporting events do have, do release a lot of carbon emissions into the atmosphere. There are several international efforts. So we talk about the United Nations framework for climate change and the sports for climate action in this episode quite a bit. But it's really being led by the United Nations and the International Olympic Committee. which has several initiatives going for them in terms of the environment and sustainability. So the International Olympic Committee by 2030 want to move beyond carbon neutrality and make the games, the Olympic Games, carbon negative. Paris 2024 wants to be climate positive. So it's really interesting to see these initiatives. The IOC also has the Olympic Forest. So part of the Great Green Wall project in Africa, which is expected to sequester 200,000 tons of CO2 equivalent over the 2021 to 2024 period. There's really interesting initiatives happening in sport on the climate change action front. And this episode with Dan really dives into, you know, what the climate change framework is, how sports can take action and sign up for it. And, it's just all things, to wrap up the sport and climate change and their how they're interrelated, this conversation. And it was a really great conversation. So everybody have a listen, and I hope you really enjoy it. So to help me with this topic, we chatted with Dan Wilcock, who was the former president and CEO of the Canada Games Council. He's held several different positions throughout his life. He was a lawyer by training and has held a number of senior leadership positions and represented the federal government of Canada around the world, including at the United Nations. So he's lived in several different countries, including Australia, the Philippines, the United States, and Canada, and also competed in many, many different sports, swimming, soccer, athletics. But I think he spent most of his time in snowboarding. So Dan was a really great addition to have on this podcast. He's extremely knowledgeable about the international frameworks around sport and climate change, and has a lot of experience in this, offsetting carbon emissions and reducing carbon emissions. So it was a really great conversation, and I hope that everybody listening enjoys it as much as I do. Okay, everybody, welcome today to my guest, Dan Wilcock, who has held many roles over the years. He is a lawyer by trade. He's worked with the federal government in Canada, and recently was the president and CEO of the Canada Games Council. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I very much appreciate it. Could you start off with telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, David, for having me on. I'm always happy to talk about these issues, because really when it comes down to it, two big passions of mine in life are sports and sustainability. So where they intersect and where we can try and harness the power of sports to improve the future of the world, then it can only be a good thing. So look, and in terms of my background, you pretty much nailed it. I've done a few different things in both those areas, and I think so it was natural to want to found a group, a community of practice called the Canadian Alliance on Sports for Climate Action, which aims to bring people together in this very space. Signatories to the UN Sports for Climate Action framework, other interested sports organizations, sustainability curious organizations, let's say, academics, governments, and consultants, et cetera. So really finding and developing a forum and a platform for people to exchange information and advance the cause in Canada.
Awesome. Yeah. So this is the, fifth episode in a climate series that I've had leading up to COP27, but the second part of a sport and climate change specific topic. So in the last episode, we've talked about sort of sport and climate resilience and adaptation for governing bodies and how they have to adapt to climate change. So in this episode, I'm really hoping we're going to focus a little bit more on sort of the carbon emissions side of it and the carbon emissions from sports and how sports organizations can really think about reducing their carbon emissions and take climate actions themselves. So that's all about this, climate action, United Nations, or the Sports for Climate Action, United Nations framework. So we'll get into that. But, so in the last episode, I did ask Greg Dingle, who was on in the last episode, asked him, the first question I asked him was about what he thinks sustainability is. And since you mentioned the word, I'm going to ask you the same thing. So what does sustainability mean to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an excellent place to start this conversation, because as you're well aware, it means different things to everybody. So typically when I talk about sustainability, I'm talking about a sort of traditional three-pillar notion of sustainability. So that's, you might have heard it referred to as the triple bottom line or the economic, environmental, and social pillars of sustainability. So really, it's ensuring that we're focusing on all these important areas in any kind of operation, really, not just sports, to make sure that your organization is contributing to a positive world. But having said that, there are a lot of other ways that sustainability can be conceptualized. You know, the Sustainable Development Goals from UN released the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015. There are 17 of them, which, you know, again, are focused on ensuring that the world is a better place, a just, healthy, humane place with good governance, good social outcomes, good environmental outcomes, good economic outcomes. So, and then, of course, there are permutations that all sorts of people and organizations apply to this sort of overall concept, depending on their context, whether it's adding a sports pillar in the sports world or ESG, environmental, social, and governance terminology is pretty popular in the corporate world at the moment. So many different ways to sort of tackle it, but all aimed at really, if you boil it down, making the world a better place for all.
Awesome. So now really getting into it. So, you know, what is the Sports for Climate Action United Nations framework? I don't know if I'm using the right name exactly. I think maybe it's the United Nations Framework for Climate Change, and under that it's the Sports for Climate Action. I'm not entirely sure, but so what is it, and how, and how does it take aim at carbon emissions in sports?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And I'm going to back up just a little bit too to provide the context for it, because, I mean, I mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015. And so the UN's obviously very active in coordinating global responses to a whole range of challenges, climate change included. So goal 13 of the Sustainable Development Goals is to take urgent action to combat climate change and its impacts. And interestingly, too, the UN, not sure if you've heard of this, David, but the UN has a general, the General Assembly has a resolution which encourages member states to effectively use all opportunities offered by sport and by its values in the implementation of the 2030 Agenda and in order to implement the Sustainable Development Goals, which I think is really powerful for our sector. I mean, the UN itself has recognized the power of sport as an enabler and a tool to achieve good. So stepping down through that, the UN system, you know, how does it implement, how does it nudge and push and encourage and support these sorts of actions? Well, often through sectoral approaches, et cetera. And so, because we have to see climate action in all sectors of our economy to get to the target set out by the Paris Agreement, for example. So the UN really landed on two sectors which it thought were particularly useful sectors to focus on, and those were fashion and sports. And because both sectors have impacts and negative impacts on climate and the environment, and both are very visible sectors around the world and engage people's passions and interests, etc. So they have the ability to really spotlight the issues, present positive case studies, and encourage all of us really to think about these issues and make some changes in our lives, whether it's personal or professional lives. So that's a long piece of background. To get to 2018, the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework was launched. It's a voluntary initiative really developed by UN Climate Change and the International Olympic Committee. And really always a big tip of the hat to both those organizations for this initiative. So it was launched in 2018 with five original commitments, to galvanize the sports sector into action. So one, promoting greater environmental responsibility; two, reducing overall climate impact; three, educating for climate action; four, promoting sustainable and responsible consumption; and five, advocating for climate action through through the sports organization's communications. So completely voluntary. At the moment, there are over 300 members globally, down from grassroots clubs through to, obviously, you know, IOC and other big international organizations. And there are six Canadian signatories. So again, internationally, it's really a community of practice, publishing resources to assist others on their climate action journey, sustainability journey, exchange of ideas and learnings and lessons, and really figuring it all out together and collectively, how to tackle the challenges of climate change in sport and through sport.
So only six Canadian organizations have signed up for it. I'm actually really surprised by that. Out of the 300, that's a really small number.
Yeah, look, I agree. And I've spent some time trying to understand why that is. So, you know, shout out to those six. And let me see if I can get them all off the top of my head. So definitely the Banff Marathon, Surf Canada, Canada Games Council, Canadian Olympic Committee, Tennis Canada, Run Ottawa, I think is the the group of six. Sorry if I'm missing someone off the top of my head. But yeah, so look, David, if you break it down, that equates to roughly 2% of the membership globally, which, you know, on a population basis might be about right for Canada globally. But I think in terms of you know, Canada as a nation, its values, its interest in both sport and sustainability, I think we can do much better for sure.
Absolutely.
And working behind the scenes to try and support and encourage others to engage with this this network.
Mm-hmm. So you were president and CEO of the Canada Games Council at the time when the Canada Games Council signed on to the agreement. So why did you think that this was a good thing? Why did you think the Canada Games Council should sign up for it?
Yeah, good question. So so that was in 2019. And again, there wasn't a lot of, well, let me step back. When I came to the Canada Games Council, I had recently been working with Environment and Climate Change Canada. So I came to that role with a sustainability lens. And, you know, my frank assessment was that Canada Games Council has always done really well on the economic side, you know, of the games, the sort of regional economic development, pretty well on the social side, I think pretty progressive, but we've all seen we can always learn and do more on the social side. It was the environmental side which had been left pretty ad hoc between games hosts. And I thought my assessment was there was a lot of room and scope for improving and bringing consistency and more strength to our efforts on the environmental side. So, you know, we started conversations amongst the staff and with the board, and the UN framework really provided an excellent framework to align with to the value. Those five commitments that I mentioned were all very much in line with the values as I saw them at that time and the board as well. And so in the end, we thought it was the right thing to do, and even though we didn't have all the answers immediately, I'm not sure anyone would say they have all the answers to these issues. It was aligned with the values and a good start to really try and improve our efforts in this area.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree that it was definitely the right move, and I think it aligns nicely with the values of the Canada Games, and especially, you know, with they just came out. We had them on a few months, Kellyanne. The new CEO, president of the Canada Games Council, we just had her on in the summer to talk about the new strategic plan, and it, you know, it fits in nicely with that as well. So I think I think environmental, all sport organizations need to have an environmental aspect and be thinking about that with their, you know, with their strategic planning for the future.
Can I pick up on that, David?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I think that's a great point. And so, you know, talking about learning on the journey as we go. So, you know, just to share some of the insights from those internal discussions and the work we did there. So really, once you commit to a direction, and the UN framework was a good way to focus our minds, then, you know, you get down to the hard nuts and bolts of, well, what does this mean? How do we operationalize this? How do we make it part of the culture? And that question is the core for a lot of organizations. This makes sense. We like it. It's aligned with our values, but what does it mean? And so we spent a lot of time working, trying to understand the Canada Games impact. And I'm sure we'll circle back to these sorts of questions later on, but trying to understand the impact, doing things like a carbon inventory, and then trying to figure out, well, what can we change and how do we implement it within the organization? So the strategic plan that you mentioned sort of is an outcome of that whole process, right? Where we looked at what we should be doing in the environmental space, the climate space, also the social space and economic, and went through the process of deciding what's right for the organization. Is it a separate standalone strategic, sustainability plan or a climate plan? And in the end, I'm pleased to say that Canada Games Council really integrated it within its overall strategic planning. And so in pillars of the organization's strat plan and objectives going forward. And so that's a way to make sure it remains on everybody's radar. That kind of focus is rolled out through every area of the operations. But, that's not always an obvious answer, how you do this within each organization with its own unique history and culture, et cetera. So just wanted to expand on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. So just kind of going back to the framework a little bit to dive into that a little bit more. So I know, I think it's been criticized for not really having any, teeth to the framework, because it is voluntary to sign up for. Maybe it's changed recently and I haven't been, and I'm not aware of it, but I know it's been criticized that people sign up for it and then there's no way to really keep them accountable to keeping to their targets or anything. Could you talk a little bit about are there specific targets that the framework asks people to sign up to do? Volunteer to sign up to do, and how does that work?
Mm-hmm. No, it's an excellent question and very much a live one. So, if we step back, so in principle, you've always got the sort of not dilemma, but the debate, I guess, between how to achieve cultural change. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about achieving a cultural change in a sector, in organizations, across the globe, to be honest, all sectors of the economy. And so, on one end of the spectrum, you've got entirely voluntary, individualistic, everyone, coming to make whatever changes they think are appropriate, through to the other end of the spectrum, a government-imposed regulatory style, one-size-fits-all approach. And we all can imagine the pros and cons, the two extremes, and then you look to find something in the middle that's appropriate in many cases. So I think what the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework did was really go for quite a voluntary, inclusive model at the start in 2018, where there were five, those commitments I mentioned before, five pretty soft commitments, and rely on the goodwill and the ethics and the values of the organizations that signed up. Now, as you say, that has no teeth. And in one way, that's a positive, because what it does, it creates a big tent where the organizations that sign up are welcome and they have a forum and an environment to learn from each other and advance their climate action agenda in the ways that seem appropriate to those organizations. Instead of, each organization operating on its own in hundreds of silos, thousands of silos around the world, trying to figure it out and reinvent the wheel. But as you say, on the other on the flip side of that is, you know, is it greenwashing? Can you just sign up and do nothing and you know, take some sort of claim that you're concerned about climate action, et cetera? There's an element to that. So what I didn't mention before is that the framework has just recently, just in the last year, introduced new requirements for all existing members and new members. And they're much more stringent. And that is organizations have to commit to reducing their actual emissions by 50% by 2030 and going zero on emissions by 2040. So those are concrete targets. And they're aligned with, you know, getting us to Paris, the Paris targets, but even a little ahead of that. So this is a good thing, but it also creates other challenges. Because right now for many sports organizations, it's pretty difficult to see how they can achieve absolute emissions reductions of 50% by 2030. So does this higher degree of stringency push people away from joining the framework and make it more difficult for them to access the resources and the support to take positive steps that might not meet that level of ambition? So I think, you know, the question remains live. And so far I'm not aware of UN kicking anyone out for not achieving the targets. You know, I think some of the conversation I've had within the framework is about whether it's appropriate to have maybe two levels, you know, associate membership to encourage people to start the journey, and then a level of ambition for the organizations that can commit to it. It's finding a balance in terms of encouraging people but not allowing it to be used for greenwashing, if you boil it down.
Why do you think that some sport organizations are finding it difficult to reduce their carbon? Like, why are they concerned about not being able to meet the 50% reduction by 2030?
Yeah, so I would say that the key thing, so let me again just step back for a second. So you very appropriately introduced the mitigation versus adaptation distinction before. So this, you know, this conversation, obviously, we're going right to the mitigation questions, which, you know, if that terminology is not familiar to anyone, it's really talking about reduction of your greenhouse gas emissions. And as I said before, to achieve the Paris agreements, we really need absolute cuts. You probably heard about, you know, offsets, you know, planting trees to offset emissions that you're releasing otherwise. But I think that the focus right now is we have to achieve absolute cuts in emissions. We have to stop releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And then offsetting is a strategy that we can use to try and help address unavoidable emissions. So with that background, there's a guy, the guy who runs Forest Green Rovers, a kind of famous sustainable football club in the UK, he breaks it down really well. He talks about transportation, energy, and food being really 80% of the emissions in sports, well, in many areas, but in sports. So that's really where good places to put your focus. And what we've seen is in sports is that transportation in particular is a huge driver of greenhouse gas emissions from the sports world. So Canada Games Council, the carbon inventory there showed that well over 90% of its emissions were from travel, and particularly participant travel, getting all the athletes and officials to the games every 2 years. So that is the source of the challenge for the sports sector, is that transportation emissions for many organizations are the bulk of mm-hmm. Bulk of their emissions. So to make absolute reductions forces some pretty tough conversations. And these, by the way, are often referred to as scope 3 emissions. These are the indirect downstream emissions. And also the debate revolves around fan travel too. You think about fans traveling to, say, the Olympics. There's a whole lot of emissions involved there. So it's really challenging to reduce these emissions without major structural changes in transportation. Mm-hmm. And or significant changes in the business model of sports. We're starting to see both, but that's the core of the challenge, I would say.
Okay. So do you have any, have you seen any really great examples of sport organizations reducing their carbon emissions? Like something that can, a really great initiative or a really good example of that another organization can replicate?
Yeah, there's a whole range for sure. Let me I sort of mentioned these two categories on transportation. So the structural changes in the business models. Let me start with the structural changes because I think we can deal with that one pretty quickly. That's an area that sport doesn't have real control over, but can be involved in and advocate for, etc. Really, we're talking about aviation. So we are starting to see electric planes becoming a realistic technology. So Air Canada just put in an order for, I think it was 30 electric planes to come in the fairly near future. Mm-hmm. At first, they'll only really help for short hop routes. We're not talking long distance solely on electric yet, but obviously the technology's evolving. So that's promising. We're seeing a lot more about sustainable aviation fuel, which is also promising. So the International Civil Aviation Authority also just adopted a long-term goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. So again, that's not the sort of fast timeline that we would need in the sports sector to achieve such major reductions by 2030, but there is progress happening. So really it's the innovative aircraft technologies, streamlining the sort of operations and deploying sustainable aviation fuels that'll get us there in the longer term. So where can sport focus immediately while that's happening in the transportation sector? It's really on our business models, right? There are all sorts of fascinating examples that are emerging now. People are getting pretty creative. I'll start with COVID lessons. I mean, we've all seen that we can travel a lot less. So I think we just have to be willing to see and acknowledge that, particularly on the administrative side of sports, et cetera, it gets harder to avoid athlete travel, but on the administrative side, there are a lot of things we can do. And, I think it was World Sailing, who has been trialing this, doing this incredible pilot of using officials based remotely for their events now. So they don't leave home, they're connected, the cameras are, I think the drones are up flying, showing them the scene halfway around the world, and they're officiating remotely. So these kinds of developments would have been hard to imagine a couple of years ago as being taken seriously, but they're being rolled out now, which is fantastic. I think there are a number of other just practical operational steps that we can take. For example, Major League Baseball has started looking at its new schedules much more carefully for future years, and they'll be changing them to have less travel and streamlining the schedule so that people aren't crisscrossing the continent as much as they have been in the past. They're sort of more efficient scheduling. So we'll probably see the Blue Jays on a bit of a different schedule going forward. So again, that those sorts of lessons can be applied to many sports, particularly whether national tours or global tours is really focusing in a particular region first, and then moving on to a new region rather than spreading them out through the calendar and crisscrossing the nation or the globe with the associated emissions there. Unfortunately, on the flip side, we saw Formula One just expand its calendar, and it's still flipping around the world, going back and forth. So, not everybody's reading from that hymn book yet. But yeah, that's on the transportation side more. Do you want me to keep going with some other areas, David? Or
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
yeah, okay,
Yeah.
no worries. And again, this sort of thing is the real benefit of having these networks, the UN network, the Canadian Alliance, because we can share the sort of lessons learned, and all sorts of organizations can apply them in their own context. Let's say other examples in Canada. I mean, the Banff Marathon's always been an innovator in Canada, and which is wonderful because it's such an iconic location, such an extraordinary. In terms of marathons worldwide, you'd be hard pressed to find many in more beautiful environments than that. But Joey O'Brien over at the Banff Marathon is working hard always on new ideas to improve what they're already doing. So now they're working on innovative waste disposal techniques, which, I'm not sure I fully understand the details of their pilot project there, but it's also not just diversion, waste diversion, but capturing emissions from the disposal of the waste and circular economy principles. Tennis Canada is another great example. These guys have been quietly ahead of the pack for a while now. They have pretty ambitious 2030 targets. And they're interesting because not only are they a national sporting organization, but they're also obviously a very major event holder with the what is it, the National Bank Open, they're calling it now. So they're always improving the way they're doing things. Commonwealth Sport Canada, you might have seen just for the Commonwealth Games this year, they took the great step of committing to making Team Canada carbon neutral for the games, and they've achieved that. They're achieving that through a commitment to offsetting their emissions in the Great Bear Rainforest out in BC. So I think it's a really neat project. They've got it squarely on their radar. Canada Games Council, as you're aware, it's part of their strategic planning now, and I think soon, if not already released, that I know they're working up the offsetting from the Niagara Games this year, which is a great development. Canadian Olympic Committee, they've actually committed to that high ambition track that I was talking about for the Sport for Climate Action framework, and they're really gearing up now. There's some really great action behind the scenes, led by Catherine there, to tackle the way the COC does business and look at bringing the whole NOC community in Canada along with them. So I think those are some of the sort of Canadian specific examples, but happy to drill down in other areas if you've got some curiosity in particular areas.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you for all that. And there's some really interesting initiatives. I know that the IOC is really active on it as well. Like the Olympic House is, like, according to them, one of the most sustainable buildings in the world. I'm not sure if that's entirely accurate, but according to them, it is. But obviously the IOC does have a lot more resources than a lot of other sport organizations, but they do have quite a few really interesting initiatives going on from that organization.
Yeah, if I can just pause on that. So, funnily enough, Olympic House was the last international trip I was on before the lockdowns happened. So I had the good fortune to visit in Lausanne, and you're right about the resources. It's a beautiful building, the design is incredible. So it shows you what you can do when you have resources at your disposal. And one of the striking things was side in the parking lot there, they had a hydrogen refueling station for their hydrogen fleet of vehicles. They can set an amazing example in ways that your more grassroots club probably can't aspire to just yet. But again, I think we need that. We need to the role that it's playing is really important because they're trying different technologies, they're trying different things, and we can all learn what works and what doesn't from that experience.
For sure. So you've mentioned the Sport for Climate Action Canadian Alliance a couple of times since you're the founder. So with these podcasts, I really like to highlight resources that people can go to. So if there's a Canadian organization listening that wants to reach out or become part of the alliance, how can they do that?
Yeah, no problem. So look, as I said before, the Alliance is really just the whole goal behind it is a community of practice. It's a network to connect people, and because a lot of the best learning and support in this area is peer to peer, to be honest. Finding people who've already worked through the same challenges you're facing. And so that's the goal of the network is to try and achieve that. Sports, we must all have some competitive bone somewhere in our bodies to be involved in sports. But this area, I think you'd find is really collaborative and collegiate. So Canadian Alliance is just that. It's not like a single person or entity. It's a network. And the easiest way in is probably the LinkedIn page where I update with stories and examples and case studies that I think would be relevant for the Canadian sport community. Can certainly reach out to me. I can put people on the list for, at the moment we're doing quarterly regular calls and then where we get together and update each other on developments in Canada and globally that are relevant. And then the benefit, of course, is that you get to know who else is operating in the space and can start to reach out directly to people on various initiatives. To answer your question, feel free to contact me, danwilcock@gmail.com, or through the LinkedIn page and through Instagram. Kind of they're the environments we're operating in right now. Can add anyone to the list. It's an open tent,
Awesome.
and we value any contributions that anyone wants to make to the network.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'll add the LinkedIn and your email into the show notes so people can find it there easily.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Yeah.
So awesome. Dan, thank you so much. So just before we end, do you have any last messages to everybody listening?
Ooh. Should have prepared for this in advance. No, so I think yes, I do is the answer. And those messages would be if you're listening to this at this point in the podcast, you're sustainability curious. That's wonderful. My advice would be if you're thinking about it for your organization or for your sports, just jump in. No one has all the answers. I know it can be a bit intimidating at first trying to figure out what to do and how to improve in this space. Just jump in, start the journey. We're all trying to figure it out as we go along together. And that's the strength of the networks that we can help each other along and it's collaborative. So, and the resources are structured so that you can observe and listen and learn, and there's no expectations of you to know and be a leader and knowledgeable immediately. And so number one, just take a step, jump in, And before you know it, you'll be an expert on scope 1, 2 emissions and all sorts of novel issues that you might not have expected. The other thing I would say is, if you're with a sports organization, you probably can't ignore it. And so it's always better to be proactive with new challenges that are coming our way. In terms of adaptation, so many sports are being forced to address that now, with extreme weather, changing weather patterns, heat, loss of snow, all those things that you've talked about on previous episodes. So adaptation is thrust upon us. It's here. So it has to be tackled. And I would say that mitigation is really just part of our responsibility as people who are passionate about sports. Most sports are rooted in natural environments. We love them, and we want all our future children and human colleagues to have the same wonderful experiences that have shaped our lives. And so it's the right thing to do to care about these issues and to try and future-proof sports. So those would be my takeaway messages.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dan, again, for taking the time to join me today and talk about sport and climate change. It was a really great and interesting conversation, and I hope that everybody is sustainability curious after this episode and really wants to take more action.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, and thanks for all that you're doing, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you once again to Dan for taking the time to speak with me today about sport and climate change and the international frameworks. So my key takeaways from this episode are first that it takes a lot of people doing things imperfectly to get started, right? As Dan was saying, we're all on the same journey, right? Nobody's gonna be perfect right away, so we need to just jump in, take the first step, and start doing things imperfectly. The climate crisis won't be solved by 10 people doing things perfectly, but it will be solved by 1 million people doing things at least better than we're currently doing. So we need to definitely start. The second is, I guess that my second key takeaway, I guess, is that there's a lot of opportunity in sport to talk about many different issues. While we are really constrained by the travel aspect and the transportation of athletes and equipment and officials and everything like that, but there's a lot of opportunities to talk about these issues through sport, to have these conversations. We've talked about on this episode before how sport clubs can engage fans in sustainable eating practices. So there's a lot of opportunities for sports to, while they may not be able to reduce their carbon emissions right away, there are smaller actions that they can take to reduce their carbon emissions and also engage people to reduce their own carbon emissions. So I think there's lots of opportunities and ways for sport to grow into this and to take a leadership role and engage people on this really important topic. So that's it for this episode of the Sport and Climate Change Part 2. And next week, we'll be back with the sixth episode of the climate series leading up to COP27. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll chat with you next time.